Has more mitzvos than any other parsha in the whole Torah. There are actually more than 50 mitzvos in Kiseitzeh. The whole Torah is 613, this says 50. So this is 1/12 of all the mitzvos in the Torah. And we don't have time or the opportunity to go through all of them. But I do want to discuss one mitzvah, both because of the ethical problem that's involved, and in terms of, it's very, very difficult to even understand what's exactly going on. And that is the first mitzvah of Eishes Shefas Toar, when you see a beautiful woman in time of war.
Yeah. Rabbi Mendel talked a little bit about this on Monday.
Yes.
So he had left us with a statement of saying that this shows us, this is one proof, that we don't necessarily hold by the sheret, like the things. And so I was, because he said, you know, if that was the case, then you'd have this, you know, bad child that would come from it.
Yeah.
And that shows you that surely it wasn't meant to be, because if it wasn't, you wouldn't have the bad child come from it.
Right.
So we never have, we've never had a case of this child being put to death either. So that would appear to me to contradict the statement that it proves that there's no sheret.
I'm not sure what Rabbi Mendel meant when he says there's no Bashert. There certainly is a Bashert, but there's no guarantee you will get your Bashert, and you can certainly mess it up by making wrong choices. So I think the most you could say is that there is no guarantee that a person has hitched up with the person that God has destined for him, because that is the interaction of human free will. By the way, I don't want to talk about that whole subject now, but let me just mention one very interesting Gemara that one should be aware of. It's both scary and exhilarating at the same time. And that is, you know, you're normally not allowed to get married on Shabbos, of course, and on Yom Tov, but you're not even allowed to get married on Chol HaMoed, even though it's not a full Yom Tov, because it says that since on Chol HaMoed I'm supposed to rejoice in the holiday, I don't want to intermingle my simchas of thinking about the wedding and the joy of Yom Tov. But in the time of the Gemara, weddings used to be in two stages. There was the betrothal, when you would give the ring, and then there was the consummation. Today we have them all together, Erusin and Nisuin. But the Gemara says, at a time when we did Erusin separately, you are allowed to do Erusin even during Chol HaMoed. And the reason is, because if I don't marry her now, maybe somebody else will get her. So I'm allowed to kind of do it. And Rashi explains, even though God decreed who your wife would be, but maybe somebody else will have a bigger zechus through his davening to get the person that was destined for you, and therefore you're permitted to jump the gun, so to speak. So there is a concept that's why the Bashert thing really should not be in our mind that much, because in truth, it is not a very helpful idea. It is a true idea, but it's a true idea that doesn't give me any guidance or insight, because there's nothing I can do with it. I have no way of knowing, number one. Number two, Bashert could be changed by many things, by somebody else davening or by you davening. Let's say your Bashert was not necessarily supposed to be so good for you. Hashem decreed you need to suffer that penance. Through prayer, you can get something better. Also, age affects things. Beyond a certain age, we say there's no bashert anymore, that's canceled, and everything depends on merit. So this is an idea. Judaism has, I hate to talk this way because it's not the most reverent way, there are many ideas in Judaism that are all true, but they're not useful as a daily way of structuring your life. And I would say the idea of bashert is not a fundamentally useful idea, because there's no way you can know and there's nothing you can do with it. So as a result, you look for whatever is best for you. And in many, many ways, many Bali Musar say, you make your bashert, meaning even if it's not the one God decreed, that doesn't mean you can't make a deep and meaningful and wonderful relationship with what you have. So in effect, bashert is something you make, not only something that you get. So you have to look at it that way. But when I want to talk about Eishes HaFas Toar, obviously there are moral problems here, but I want to talk about something even on a more basic level. And that is, it seems to be a big example of what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is when you're hit with two contradictory ideas at the same time. Does the Torah... Now again, the situation here is, it's time of war. In time of war, passions are very great. People are afraid, people are anxious, people are aroused. And there is an unusual concept here, which we don't find anywhere else, that the Torah makes a concession to the Yetzer Hara of a person by basically saying, if you're not able to control yourself, we will give you a legitimate way to have intercourse with this Gentile woman that attracts you. And the Torah permits you, in time of war only, in time of war only, to have sexual intercourse, again, whether it applies today is another question, I'll get to that, with a woman you're attracted to. Now, question number one is, are we talking about rape? It's not clear. So the truth of the matter is that there is a passage in the Toras Kohen, in the Sifri, which seems to indicate that the dispensation of Yifas Toar is not a dispensation for rape in time of war, which would be a crime and a sin, but it is a dispensation for a consensual sexual relationship. That at least takes away one level of the moral problem, that this is not a parsha dealing with rape, this is a parsha dealing with consensual sexual intercourse. Now, it's still a whole bunch of averus. She's a non-Jew. It's a great, great sin. But here the Torah says, Dibra Torah keneged Yetzer Hara, because if we wouldn't matter it, you would do it anyway. Now, let me ask a question like that. First of all, the Satmar Rebbe used to point out that people often say, I'm not able to control myself. I have to sin. The Satmar Rebbe says that can't be true, because the one place where the Torah says you can do it because you can't control yourself, the implication is everywhere else you could control yourself, right? Because if you really couldn't control yourself anywhere else, we would have had that other places as well. Okay. But so what? Why does the Torah have to make it mutter? Can't control yourself, say you sin. I mean, what is the point? Since you can't control yourself, we'll say it's okay. So the Satmar Rebbe says, psychologically, this is a very interesting point. Pirkei Avos says, Avera goreres avera. When you sin, you bring into your personality, you strengthen the Yetzer Hara. So the next sin becomes easier, and then, you know, you do one sin, it leads to another sin. Just like one mitzvah strengthens you to do more mitzvahs, every avera pulls you down. So here is the point. If the Torah would leave this in the realm of avera, so when it pulls me down, it's going to pull me down again and again and again and again. By the Torah taking it out of the category of an avera, it's not going to have that detrimental impact on my soul. So the basic idea is, if you're going to sin anyway, Hashem will give you a mechanism, at least in this context, to make it permitted. Now, the Torah then says, you bring her to your house for 30 days. She cries over her father and her mother. She lets her hair grow real long. She shaves off her hair, so she's bald. Her fingernails, it's machlokas, that the Torah uses an ambiguous term, the asasa, she does her nails. Machlokas in the Gemara, does that mean they grow real long, or they're cut real short? But whatever the opinion is, the point is, she is required, or you are required, to make her very unattractive. And after the 30 days, you either must send her free, you cannot enslave her, or you marry her. Now, what's going on here? Does she convert? Is she forcibly converted? Does she voluntarily convert? What if she wants to convert within the 30 days? What if you don't want to marry her? Why do I have to bring her into my home for 30 days if I have no further interest in her? Is the point, this is why I call it cognitive dissonance. On one level, the purpose of making her ugly and repulsive is that you shouldn't want her, because it's going to be a bad thing. But if you shouldn't want her, then why do I have to have her in my house for 30 days? What if I have intercourse with her and I don't want her anymore? Meaning, on one hand, the Torah is creating a mechanism to kind of encourage you to marry her. And on the other hand, the Torah is creating a mechanism to discourage you to marry her, because she's ugly, but she has to stick around for 30 days. And let me point out, all of this is after the first intercourse. You know, you don't need to do this as a condition to be with her, at least the way the Rambam learns. Rather, it's the other way around. You can be with her right away. So the question is, what exactly is the Torah trying to accomplish with this ritual? So one way of understanding it is that in a way the ritual might deter you from doing this in the first place, meaning to say the following. A person is aroused, he wants to have a quick sexual night with a woman. Again, as I said before, it's not rape, Baruch Hashem, but he wants to have a one-night stand. But if he knows ahead of time, hey mister, this one-night stand is going to cost you. You're going to have to bring her into your house for 30 days. You're going to have to support her. You're going to have to take care of her. You will not be allowed to have a follow-up sexual relationship with her. And she's going to be ugly and repulsive. So the thought might be that even if he's not dissuaded by an aveira from being with her, but sometimes the long-term, even 30 days, the long-term consequences might be unattractive enough that he says, gee, if this is going to be my cost, I won't do it. So one way of looking at the ritual of Yifas Toar is the ritual afterwards might be a deterrent from him acting on his passion. Meaning, even passion is controllable. It's an amazing thing. On one hand, the word of God might not be strong enough. I mean, God said not to do this. Elamai, we can't control ourselves. So God mocks it. On the other hand, the consequences of having to do all of this stuff might be strong enough. And it might turn around. That's one way of looking at it. But okay. But what happens during the 30 days? She's unattractive, and the whole concept is you want to send her home. So what if I want to send her home within the 30 days? Can't do it, because that's the whole point. In other words, you have to look backwards. It is only the fact that I'm stuck with her for 30 days that will act as a deterrent. If I could send her home within that time, then I don't have a deterrent. I'll just send her home like immediately. So for the 30 days, you are stuck with her. You must bring her in, even if you have no further interest. So in effect, two different things are happening here. On one hand, you bring her in order to create the deterrent against doing it in the first place. On the other hand, it is an opportunity to try to see if you want to continue the relationship. So what happens if she wants to convert consensually. So the Rambam actually says the following. The Rambam actually says, if for whatever reason she actually wants to become Jewish, she can become Jewish at any time during this process, even in the middle of the 30 days, and then you can stop the process and just marry her. If she wants to become Jewish. Yeah.
They say that the Ben Sora Mora and this have a connection.
Yep.
That if you have a relation with her, then you have Ben Sora Mora.
That's but correct, yeah.
So in which process, because it seems in my head that the Ben Sora Mora is only if she's Jewish.
Yes, so we're not talking about a child that you had from that first bia.
Right.
We're talking about if you eventually marry a woman that you got involved with through this improper initial connection.
Even if she converted.
Even if she converts, yeah. Now, if she doesn't want to convert, you keep her for the whole 30 days. Afterwards, though, if she does not, this is the Rambam, if she does not want to convert, you must set her free. Now, this is a very important rule. In time of war, people are allowed to take slaves, at least in the time of the original wars. But if you had sexual intercourse with this woman, the only two choices are she converts and she marries you, or you send her home. That's very important. You cannot enslave a woman that you had sexual intercourse with. That's a very important idea, because you've already, even if it's not rape, you've already kind of abused her in this way. And therefore, the only options that are open for you is her conversion and you're marrying her, or her being set free to be a free person going back to her non-Jewish society. You can neither sell her nor enslave her. Right, that's this rule. Now, according to the Rambam, her conversion must be voluntary. So although she is stuck in your house for 30 days, at the end of the 30 days, you ask her, well, if you're not interested, you just send her home. If you are interested, you'd say, you want to convert? And of course, it's a very strange scenario. Why would she want to convert? I mean, and if she wants to convert, let's say you're rich, you know, is she converting with Shem Shamayim? I mean, all sorts of problems here. But according to the Rambam, if she says, I don't want to convert, you got to send her home. Now, I do want to point out that there are Rishonim, and this might answer your question a bit more, that say that Yafas Toar is a Gezeiras HaKasuf, that after the 30 days, you can convert her to Judaism against her will. That's pretty amazing. Because normally, conversion has to be with the consent of the convert. Even a baby who gets converted, we convert babies, like adopted babies, when they reach bar mitzvah, they can renounce it. But according to some Rishonim, Eishes Shefas Toar can result in a forced conversion if you want to marry her. So according to many Rishonim, the scenario is after the 30 days, you can convert her and marry her, or send her home. So the common denominator is, and according to all Rishonim, the Chumash is saying, if you don't want to marry her, you must send her back to freedom. But the machlokas is, do you have the option of forcibly converting her? Then that raises the question, well, is a forcible conversion also mean a forcible marriage? It's very, very complicated. According to some, it seems you could force her into marriage as well, but then you have to support her like a wife and treat her like a wife and not treat her like a slave. So there's a lot of unknown issues here. But according to the Rambam, I think, makes it the most easiest to understand. Again, just to review the main points of the Rambam, we are not talking about rape. Number one, we're talking about consensual relations.
You said force her into marriage.
Huh?
Force her into marriage.
I didn't hear you.
You just said force, you can't force her into marriage.
According to the Rambam.
That's not consensual.
No. I'm talking about the Rambam versus... I'm going over the Rambam now. The last thing I said was not the Rambam. Now I'm reviewing...
Whose opinion was this?
Other Rishonim in Maseches Kedushin. Again, to summarize the Rambam's point, I'm talking about the Rambam's point, The Rambam's point is the initial encounter is when she's a goya. It's not rape, it's consensual. She is then forcibly brought into your home for 30 days. Her hair is shaven, her fingernails are cut. At the end of the 30 days, she is given a choice to convert to Judaism. If she does not want to convert, she does not have to convert. You must send her home to freedom. You cannot keep her as a slave. You cannot sell her to anybody else. If she wants to convert, she can. And you can then propose marriage to her. But according to the Rambam, you cannot marry her against her will. Which means, according to the Rambam, the only forcible aspect of this is she is forced to remain in your home for 30 days with no further sexual intercourse. But at the end of the 30 days, the conversion option is up to her, and the marriage option is up to her. If she doesn't want to convert, or even if she converts, but she doesn't want to marry you, you must then sever your connection with her. So at least like the Rambam, it's a type of arrangement that we can understand a little bit. Like other Rishonim, it is a bit more problematical. Even they admit that the initial encounter is not rape, but they do allow a forced conversion and a forced marriage. And that does raise certain issues. But that would also explain the Ben Sorer Omorah, because if she was forced into marriage and conversion, obviously it's not totally L'shem Shemayim. So that's why the seed, the child, would tend to be a negative child. Yeah?
Is she forced into the house after that first Biyum?
Yes. Yes. Now that's also a Machlokas Rishonim. But according to the Rambam and most opinions, she comes into the house after the first Biyum. The first Bia is before all of this. Okay, this is what you do after the first Bia.
Right, but do you force her in? What if she doesn't want to come in
yeah,
for 30 days?
That's a very big problem. And that's really the question that I raised. Meaning to say, what is the purpose and the point of bringing her in if I don't want a continued relationship? And she doesn't want a continued relationship, right? Why can't I just say, let's skip this?
I mean, she's not bound by the Torah.
She's not bound by the Torah. So this is a question, I really don't have a tremendous answer. The only answer I have is that the Torah set up this compulsory home visitation as a way of perhaps discouraging you from the initial intercourse. Because if you know that after this one night stand, you're going to be stuck with her for 30 days, that may give you a second thought about doing it.
She can't just say, I'm not coming into your house for these 30 days.
So the question is, can she make that decision?
Yeah.
In other words, am I obligated to force her?
Right.
Assuming I'm able to force her. The mashmos of the halacha is, yeah, the mashmos of the halacha is, you got to do this, and therefore she got to go along with this. After the 30 days is a different story. But again, it's very, very problematical, because on one hand, the Torah would want nothing more than you to break off this relationship. And at the same time, the Torah is requiring a certain perpetuation of a relationship the Torah wants you to break off. That's why I call it cognitive dissonance. We seem to be operating at two different levels. We want you to break it off, and yet we stick you with her for a considerable amount of time. Yeah, yeah.
What if the event after the first Bia, she's gone? As in, you don't get the chance to force
me. No, you don't know where she is.
You have no idea where she went.
Yeah, well, at that point, you can't take home somebody where you don't know who they are. If they're gone, they're gone.
But it seems like it's a responsibility of yours to bring her back to your home afterwards. So the question becomes,
do you have retroactively a sin? Meaning like this. If I had Bia and I did not follow the follow-up procedures, does that mean limafreya, retroactively, my intercourse with her was a prohibited sin? That could very well be the case. It's very unusual that whether something is a sin or not is defined by what you do later. It's very, very unusual. Normally, a sin is defined by the conditions in existence at the time of the sin. Here, you're looking at things that happen later. Now, I do want to point out, this is only one understanding. There is a whole other different understanding of Yifas Tovah, which, in a sense, makes more sense. And that is, this ceremony is a precondition for the intercourse you want to have. Meaning, the way it works is this. You are aroused. You have a passion. You want to act on it. God says, sorry, you want to do it? This is what you have to do first. It's like the idea that when you get angry, count to 10. Now that's a totally different picture. Meaning the Torah does not allow you to act upon your passion till you go through a 30-day ritual designed to discourage you. And then if you want to do it, go ahead and do it. But you probably won't want to do it. See, that's a totally different picture. That is not the idea of do it once and then go through this. It's the other way around. You want to do it once, you got to go through this first. Which would mean, in other words, you're not given a free bite at the apple, so to speak. Yeah. So this is a remarkably difficult, putting aside the ethical problems, it's a remarkably difficult mitzvah just to understand what is going on. If you were to simply write the steps that are done in this process, it would be very confusing. It is not a simple understanding of what is going on. Yeah.
The Torah is meant to be like a perfectly ethical code of law. How would you justify that it's acceptable to force someone to marry?
Well, let me backtrack with a preliminary question first, and then I'll try to address your question. And that is, hey, does any of this apply today? Israel, unfortunately, we've had wars, whether it's 48, whether it's 67, 73. Last year, we had a war, right? Is any of this going to be permitted? So let me just point out a very important Rashi. Rashi says there are two types of wars in the Torah. There are what are called mitzvah wars. Mitzvah wars are obligation wars, wars that you must wage. And there are three types of mitzvah wars. Two of them we don't have today. One mitzvah war is to destroy Amalek. We don't really have Amalek today. We have maybe ideological Amalek, but we don't have the actual nation of Amalek. The other is a mitzvah to destroy the seven nations of Canaan, which again are extinct. Hittites, no. Although Yale University recently produced a Hittite dictionary, but there are no Hittites around. The third war is a war to defend the Jewish people from enemies that want to destroy it. Those are the wars that unfortunately Israel faces today. So the wars that we fight are mitzvah wars of type 3. They're wars of defense. Now, those three wars are called Milchemes Mitzvah. Now, there's another category of war that's called Milchemes Rishus, optional wars. Now, this is also going to be an ethical problem as well. An optional war means an aggressive war of expansion. You're telling me that the Torah allows Jews, we'd like to conquer Syria or conquer Saudi Arabia or conquer Cyprus? We can just wage a war? Well, the answer is you could, but there are so many conditions that it's impossible today. You have to have a Sanhedrin that authorizes it, which we don't have. Most importantly, you need prophetic authorization from the Urim V'Tumim that the Kohen Gadol wears. Everyone knows what the Urim V'Tumim is? It is the motto of Yale University. Perhaps you may know. If you look at the logo of Yale University, it has Hebrew letters on it, Urim V'Tumim. And the Urim V'Tumim was the Kohen Gadol's breastplate, and it had jewels for all the tribes of Israel, and there were letters of the tribes engraved on the stones. And when there was prophecy, The Kohen Gadol would ask God for guidance, and God would answer by letters glowing. You have to have very short questions, really, because you don't really have a lot of letters there. Kain or lo, you have to do it like yes or no questions. But the letters would glow and shine, and they would give an answer. So that basically means wars of expansion are justified only when God gives you a direct answer. So if God tells me it's okay, it's okay. But that means today, where we don't have prophecy, there is no halachic justification for aggressive wars of expansion. The only halachic heter we have to wage war is wars of defense. So the basic message here is, there is in halacha a concept called optional war, but it requires specific divine authorization. So de facto, we can't do it on our own, and we don't do it on our own. Now, Rashi makes the point, that's maybe counterintuitive, that the heter of Yefas Toar is only in an optional war. It's not in a mitzvah war. Mitzvah wars do not have this dispensation. So my bottom line is, therefore, if you are a soldier in the IDF, you would not be permitted to do any of this today, because every war that the IDF fights is in the nature of a defensive war, that is a mitzvah war, and in mitzvah wars, Yefas Toar does not apply. So at a minimum, what I'm saying to you is that this then would not apply in any war today.
But I mean, it doesn't change the fact it was acceptable.
Now, the question is, why was it acceptable? So again, once again, the fact that it's not rape, I think, is a very important consideration. I mean, that lowers the severity of the moral infraction. Right?
If you take someone as your wife against your will, it's virtually...
Well, again, so it all depends how you interpret this. Meaning, again, let me emphasize, according to the Rambam, you cannot take her against her will. Remember, according to the Rambam, the only aspect that is against will is she's stuck in your house for 30 days, in which you cannot have relations with her during that time. At the end of the time, it is her choice to convert or to be married to you. And if she says no, she goes free. You cannot sell her or enslave her. So, according, again, I'm not saying we're not eliminating the problem, but I think according to the Rambam, the problem is greatly, greatly reduced, because there is no compulsion on the conversion, and there is no compulsion on the marriage. Now, like other commentaries, like other Rishonim, there is going to be more of a problem. And here, though, all I can tell you is that there may be certain mystical premises here, which you may or may not accept, but they do come into play. The Orach Chaim HaKadosh, one of the great Kabbalistic commentators on the Chumash, basically says, how would this soldier be attracted to this non-Jewish woman? And he says that there is something in his soul that is attracted to the holiness in her soul, that she might be a trapped spark of holiness that once was Jewish many generations ago, and the like. And therefore, it might be under those circumstances, if such a passion exists, it may be indicative of the fact that this woman has a Jewish soul that needs to be reunited with Judaism. And in that sense, there might be some room for compulsion. But it is a difficult idea to fully understand. Yeah?
Does this only apply if you're fighting with a Jewish army? Let's say if you're in the American army.
Yes, it only applies to a Jewish army. That's right, it's a Jewish army.
So if you're, like, say you were in Vietnam and that happened. Never would apply.
It would not apply. And of course we know that rape in time of war is a very, very, very common problem, and it is a war crime, technically, although a lot of people get away with it.
But it wasn't.
It was not. In the ancient world, it was not. So I think it is very important to understand that Yefas Toar is not a legitimation of rape. Again, what we try to do sometimes is, you know, we are limited in terms of our intellect. So there are things in the Torah we don't fully understand, but at least you make the problem less. You don't get rid of the problem, but you can shrink it from gigantic to maybe medium size. That I think is already a certain amount of progress in our ability to deal with a difficult situation. Yes.
Are these wars can you only classify these wars as mental wars if it's at the time of the basic English? Because this is really the first time we've been all together.
No, okay, so the answer is no. The answer is that whenever the Jewish people are in danger, no matter whether there's a temple or not, there is a mitzvah to wage war against the enemy that tries to destroy us. That is called a mitzvah war. By the way, I don't want to be too controversial. Maybe I should give you another share on this. And that is, you know, we read in last week's Parsha, different people are exempt from going to war. The person who married a woman and did not consummate the marriage, the person who built a house and didn't live in the house yet, the person who planted a vineyard and didn't enjoy the fruit. So all of them go home. They don't have to go to war. The Mishnah says that only applies to optional wars. But mitzvah wars, everybody has to fight. Now, that raises a very important question. Again, if most of you are American citizens, you don't have to confront it necessarily. And that is the issue of the draft exemption for people who are learning in yeshiva. We know that historically, at least from Ben-Gurion's time, people who were learning in yeshiva were exempt from military service. We do know that recently, the past few years, maybe 2 years ago, the law was changed. And theoretically, still working out the details, but theoretically, for an Israeli citizen at least, there is compulsory military service after, you know, you're still given a certain amount of learning time and the like. And as you know, generally speaking, the yeshiva Torah community is very much against this, and they protest and they say this is unfair. Some people will go to jail, are willing to go to jail over this. Other people are willing to leave Israel because of this. And we have demonstrations and million man marches and all sorts of things. Now, here's the halachic question. I just want to throw out a halachic question. Given the fact that the wars that the state of Israel fights are not optional wars, they are treated as defensive wars to defend the Jewish people. And the Mishnah says in Maseches Sota that there are no exemptions for mitzvah wars. I don't want to get in trouble here, because I'm not espousing a position. I'm throwing out a question that I will address. Would it stand to reason, therefore, that everybody has to be willing to fight? Now, that doesn't have to mean 100%, because no army in the world ever has 100%. And we also believe that Torah learning and prayer and mitzvahs are an essential component of the victory that God gives us. And without that, we're totally in danger. But on the other hand, to simply say, I don't have to be in the army because I'm learning, that may contradict the principle that in Milchemes Mitzvah, there are no exemptions. Again, we'll talk about this because I think it's something that we need to talk about a little bit. In other words, just from a pure halakhic, putting aside the ideology, putting aside the politics of it, right? That's going to be the question. If the wars today are Milchemes Mitzvah, now, of course, one might make the following argument. One might make the argument, well, Milchemes Mitzvah is when we're fighting a war. So maybe when we're actually fighting a war, if they need guys in the base measures, they could schlep them out. But when we're not fighting a war, there's no war. So why should I leave the base medrash for basic training and everything else? But yeah, but that's kind of a funny situation, because if somebody's not trained, you know, it's going to be very hard to say, you know, you never saw a rifle in your life, you know. Okay, now you got to start, you know. So in a sense, that's going to, again, I'm just raising it as questions. If in the actual war, everybody is liable to do their part, shouldn't that mean that there might be an obligation to do basic service in preparation? Or do we say, hey, don't fight until you have to? Now, I will tell you that back in 1948, there are even great rabbis. Some of them were involved in, they weren't necessarily part of the official army, but they were involved in helping in the effort. Rav Chaim Kanevsky, one of the great Gedolim, remembers shooting a rifle. He had stories about this. He was involved in some, I think maybe it was only a day or so, but he was involved in some military activity against the enemy. So we'll talk about this a little bit. But as they say, the perplexity that you're raising about this mitzvah is a very, very difficult one. As they say, I myself have trouble just understanding what on earth is going on here. Meaning, what are the steps here? Very, very complicated. And then you step back and you ask yourself, is this the moral vision that God wants to give the Jewish people about having intercourse with Gentiles in time of war and then trying to force them into marriage? Now, all I can tell you is that the Torah does say there's going to be very, very nasty consequences, meaning you'll have rebellious children and bad things are going to happen. So this is certainly not something the Torah desires. It might be something the Torah tolerates within certain boundaries. And again, according to Maimonides, the coercion factor is greatly minimized because both the conversion and the marriage have to be done with her consent. So you make it a little better. Yeah?
But since we never had a Ben Sodom Torah,
yes,
that not also mean that we never had this case?
Okay, so let me explain something. Yeah. No, that's absolutely not so, because the Gemara records a number of people who had these wives. Now you may say, so what do we mean we never had Ben Sora Mora? It simply means this: we never had a Ben Sora Mora that actually had to be put to death, because being put to death had many, many technicalities. But the notion that you'll have a rebellious son with a bad nature, that unfortunately has happened and will happen. So it doesn't mean you're not going to have the negative consequence. It just means the technical requirements for actual execution have never been met. Okay? Yeah.
Are we free to assume that there's had consequences in the next world as well for doing
this? I would assume so. It's hard for me to predict. Again, one thing you need to know about the Torah is there are times the Torah legitimates things even though it is not the will of God that they be done. One might make an example of polygamy. We know that throughout the Torah, and even in Talmudic times, polygamy was permitted. But in many ways, it was not the desire of God. The ultimate desire of God is, what does the Torah say? A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. That's certainly a monogamous ideal. But the Torah tolerated things that people did. Slavery might be an example. It is not the desire of the Torah that we have slavery. But slavery was an accepted institution in the ancient world. It would have been too difficult to go cold turkey. So what God did was, he legitimated it within a framework in which it was more humane and more compassionate than it otherwise be. But that doesn't mean the Torah wants you to have slaves. Now, in a more controversial example, this is controversial, the Rambam says that's exactly korbanos. Now that's controversial, but the Rambam says in the Guide to the Perplexed that God doesn't care about killing animals and roasting them on an altar. God is not a carnivore. But people were attracted to idolatrous rituals and ceremonies and pageantry. And they were even into human sacrifices. And this is an emotional need they had to express their worship. So God gave them a framework of being able to do it without the excesses and the cruelty of the ancient sacrifices. Now, that's a very difficult example, because we pray for the restoration of sacrifices. According to the Rambam, why would we pray for that? That's a strong question. But the point of all of my examples is that the toleration of something is not reflective of what the true divine will is. It's certainly the divine will that we don't do the Yifas Torah and the like, but God said the passions were so strong that we couldn't just prohibit it, so we legitimate it in various ways. Okay, we'll stop here. Yeah, good day. Yep.